Planta on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. Emily White joins me again. She has just published a new book, Dutch Feast. It's an extensive cookbook on Dutch cuisine, apparently the first published in North America in 30 years. In the book, she explores the flavors of Dutch food, its influences, especially through what's available locally and seasonally, but the Dutch colonizing history as well. The book's recipes are easy to follow, and there's not much in terms of ingredients that would require a big shop at the grocery store. I suspect one would have a lot of the stuff on hand already. At the same time, there are unique flavors to explore, and those can be had in Dutch food at breakfast, delicious dinners, and of course desserts. Sugar and chocolate are staples. And the ingredients we see time and again, potatoes, apples, cabbage, and onions, are affordable. Emily White was first on the program in 2015 when her first book, Well Fed Flat Broke, was first published. Like that book, this new one is published by Arsenal Pulp Press, and they've done a great job. Dutch Feast looks good. The website for more is at wellfedflatbroke.com. Please welcome back to the Planta on the Line program, Emily White. Ms. White, good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Thanks for coming in to do this. As I was telling you, it's such a gorgeous book.
Well, thank you.
And it's in hardcover, unlike the first one.
It is. I think it's nicer for cooking out of because you're not worried as much about spills. It's easy
yeah.
to wipe off.
And the photography is wonderful.
Oh, that's Tracy. She's a fantastic photographer.
Yeah, and so you made the stuff and then she took the pictures?
Yep. It was a four-day sort of endurance run. We did all the photos in 4 days. So just cooking and shooting, just rapid succession.
Yeah, and it must be... Do you cook differently because of having to photograph something as opposed to having to eat something?
No. What's interesting is Tracy's whole approach is it should look like it's going to look when you make it.
When it's on the table. Yeah.
So it's styled nicely, but most of the recipes will look pretty much the way they do in the book. She sort of livens it up a bit, but it's not meant to trick you.
Yeah, and it's one of those. This is one of those cookbooks that you look at, and you look at the photographs. And you think, you read most cookbooks and you're afraid right away because you're scared that it's not going to look like that.
Oh.
But when you actually do the stuff, because I made a couple of things out of this, it looks pretty close to what's in the picture. So I'm assuming that I did it right.
That's good. I hope so. I'm sure you did.
Yeah. So you married into a Dutch family. Is that right?
I did. My husband's family. So my husband's father, his parents are from Friesland in the north.
Yeah. And... it's not a cuisine that I guess a lot of us think of.
No, and I think that's because it's one of those things that I think people who make it don't talk about it. So I think it's one of those, it's kind of a homey cuisine, and maybe there's not a lot of glamour attached to it. So it hasn't been elevated the way some of the other European foods have. So.
And you've done that in this book. You've elevated it.
I hope so.
Because there's a lot that's unique in here to that part of the world. But what I found interesting... were the influences from other parts of the world, especially like Asia?
Yeah, it's huge there. In fact, some of the best Indonesian cuisine that I've had was there. So I haven't been to Indonesia, but it was really great and really well done. And those flavors really influence a lot of Dutch cuisine.
Yeah, I grew up with Filipino parents. So a lot of these flavors are familiar.
Okay.
Especially
the
living
sweet
in
soy.
Especially living in Vancouver, fish sauce and the sort, you know, that's on every table. And that's, I guess, what's great for people in this part of the world, that a lot of this stuff is readily available.
I tried to do that. So I find I don't like to buy a cookbook if I have to make a big trip and spend $40 and then never use those ingredients again. So what I've tried to do is, even where it's not necessarily traditional, make sure that those ingredients get reused again and again. So, for example, rye flour is something that appears in some recipes, but I wanted to integrate it into a few other recipes in the book to make sure that you got your mileage out of it, so you weren't just, you know, letting something languish in the back of the cupboard.
Rye flour, not as you is you, you've mentioned, not common in many pantries.
Right.
So where would you find something like that in Vancouver?
You can find it in any grocery store. It's in the baking section, but they usually have, you know, one brand of it. So that's why I didn't want you to have to go out and buy a 5-pound bag if you were just going to make, say, the breakfast bread or the waffles. So I included it in a few other things just to sort of stretch it out so that you could refer back to it. And
did your husband, Nick, did he grow up? I guess he grew up eating this food.
Some of it. So it was actually his family that it sort of inspired the book, because there's dishes that they would make that I'd never heard of before. And that's so strange because I grew up alongside Dutch kids.
Yeah.
It's just a lot of it was surprising. For example, the butter cake is fantastic, and I'd never had that before.
Yeah.
But it reminded me of shortbread, so Scottish shortbread, and sort of got me thinking about the possibilities for other dishes. It was sort of the jumping off point for a lot of research, but he had eaten the croquettes and things like boracol.
Yeah.
And
yeah. So. Yeah, the last thing you mentioned, I'm not going to even try to pronounce that. I want to try making that.
Yes.
And would you tell us what that is?
It's basically a mash of potatoes, kale, onions, and it's often served with sausage and gravy.
Yeah.
So a really nice weeknight comfort food dish,
yeah,
especially this time of year.
Yeah, like kale and potatoes. Well, we can get that year-round, but especially this time of year, they're particularly special.
Yeah.
Because they're in harvest and
they're at their peak.
And you can get all kinds of potatoes.
Yeah.
You know.
What's interesting is my mother-in-law actually has cans of boracol.
Huh.
So you can buy it at the Dutch store in New Westminster, but it's just handy to have on hand all the time. She just opens a can, heats it up for the grandkids, and they have some sausage and boracol when we're having something else.
So in your house... Mm-hmm. Because your husband grew up eating this stuff,
mm-hmm,
and I'm assuming now your son,
yep,
eats this stuff regularly. Is it something that they enjoy regularly?
They do. So they're simple. A lot of the food is really simple and straightforward, and it's just comfort food, and a lot of it's really wholesome. So it's at its most basic. It's not a lot of challenging flavors. It's very easy to put together. Goes well with a lot of butter. So.
Yeah.
Certainly my son's on board.
And you don't have margarine in your house, I'm assuming.
No margarine for us. I'm a purist.
The food is hearty. It's comforting. It's comfort food, essentially.
Mm-hmm.
And if someone said to you, well, it's just boiled mush, what would you tell them if you had to explain it to them, what Dutch food is?
Well, I mean, everybody has a boiled mush.
Right.
You know, every culture has some mash of veggies or grains that is just a hearty, wholesome dish. It's a comfort food. And certainly there are many Dutch mushes. They have a whole genre of that called stumpots. Stumpets. I always pronounce that a little bit wrong. But
yeah.
At its heart, it's just a mash of things that go well with meats or other vegetables. But that's not all there is to it, for sure.
Yeah. And so did you have to do a lot of research in terms of putting this book together?
Yeah, I wanted to do... So there was a book that came out in the 80s called Let's Go Dutch, and it's kind of been the main cookbook on people's shelves who like Dutch cuisine. And it's a really great book, but it's a little dated at this point, and some of the ingredients are harder and harder to find. So I wanted to look at the cuisine of Dutch people who've moved to Canada, and I also wanted to incorporate some of those other influences from, say, the Caribbean and from Indonesia and other places in the world where they've sort of had trading posts or where they've occupied.
Yeah. Like Aruba, for example. I never thought that was that one of their colonies back in the...
Yeah, it's still part of the Kingdom of the Netherlands.
I see. Huh.
Yeah, so... But that's an interesting place because it was... The Caribbean was important to the Dutch because sugar was important to the Dutch, and so they were there for a long time, and they're still... Dutch culture is still
really
prominent there, so... I didn't want to just do a book of, you know... really tightly regional cuisine. I wanted to sort of look at the whole culture and see what we could bring in from that.
Now, there's a lot there were a lot of Dutch settlers who came throughout the 18th, 19th, and 20th, early 20th century,
mm-hmm,
to the east coast of the United States.
Yeah.
And so you go up and down, say, Pennsylvania, New York, you see a lot of these, the street names and the city names.
Yeah.
But the influence is there in terms of the food, isn't it?
Sure is, yeah. So there was... a few major waves of migration. So the first one would have been New Amsterdam, which is now New York.
Uh-huh.
And so that group of settlers would have brought some of the things that we sort of know as American, like coleslaw and pancakes and apple pie. Those kinds of things were some of the things that are sort of folded themselves into North American culture. And then later groups of people came through sort of the Midwest and at the center of Canada, parts of Ontario. And then after the war, Canada was sort of warmly regarded. They liberated the Netherlands. And so there was a wave of people that came in the 1950s as well. And they brought their own sort of take on what was modern at the time. So.
Well, that's the same thing with Chinese food, even French food. I mean, wherever it goes,
yeah,
there is, it takes from where it is. And I guess we've taken so much from Dutch cuisine that we don't even regard it as on its own, right? I mean, fries and things like that. I mean,
yeah, those are that's that whole part of Europe. I mean, that food is it's so important to what we eat here, but we don't necessarily identify it as having its origin there. I think we know, but we don't really. It's North American food.
Yeah. I was in the grocery store the other day, one of these chains, and I noticed that cabbage was on sale. Mm-hmm. And as I've grown up, I've started to enjoy these things I didn't like as a kid.
Yeah.
And cabbage, so I bought a head of cabbage, I guess that's what you call it,
mm-hmm.
and it was rather affordable. It didn't cost a great deal. And I guess this is the right time for something like cabbage.
Yeah.
There are recipes in here for that?
Yep, there is. There is actually a really nice wine-braised cabbage to serve at Christmas time with really nice warm spices. And certainly things like sauerkraut are ingredients in some of our boiled mushes. Mm-hmm. But
yeah. Sauerkraut, is that uniquely Dutch? Or
No. I think that's kind of all over that part of Europe where
that part
you
of the
want
world,
it to
yeah.
preserve.
Yeah. The other thing that I liked about this book is that the recipes are adaptable. For example, there are things in here that I don't like or that I can't have, like cinnamon, for example.
You don't like cinnamon?
I'm allergic to it,
oh, okay.
So that's the problem. I mean, I probably don't like it anymore because of, you know.
Yeah.
But if a recipe calls for that, I can take that out, right?
Yeah. Absolutely. I think most of them are pretty open to some adaptation.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, a little allspice might be nice instead.
Yeah. What's the process like when you're at home and testing these recipes out and formulating them? How do you know that it's a cup of this and not, say, a cup and a half? I mean, is there a lot of work that one has to do in terms of the testing?
I've made a lot of really bad versions of stuff getting it right.
Really?
So, for example, there's a pastry. It's a Limburg tart, and the rice tart is actually my favorite. But it's a yeasted tart dough, which is really hard to do because you don't want it to overproof because then it explodes and you can't fill it.
Yeah.
But you don't want it. You still want the yeast in there because it's essential. And that took me months just to get that, just understanding how much yeast was to go in there, how much flour and the moisture, but also how long to sort of mix it so that you're not activating the gluten. And so it was months of trial and error and several tart pans died. And
but it's fun though, isn't it?
It is. It's kind of like problem solving and it's creative, which it's different from what I spend my day doing. So
You work in academia, I understand, is that right?
I communicate about the brain.
Yeah. And then I guess you do one does have to use their brain when they're in their kitchen.
It's ideal.
Yeah. I mean I know so many people who just sort of walk through it and then complain about their cooking.
Oh.
But I mean, you know, you do have to think while you're in there. But this is a great way to, when you have it propped up in the kitchen there,
mm-hmm.
you can look at it and see what you like and what you don't like and fix what, you know, in my case, what I can't have.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And I always remember when I grew up looking at, so if you look at my parents' cookbooks, for example, something would be crossed out and they'd change an amount to suit their taste. So I always think that the recipes, they're as good as I could get them to my taste, and you can do what you want with them from there. So if you want a half a cup of butter where it calls for.
Dutch macaroni, how is that different from the macaroni that I guess we're familiar with?
Well, it's kind of, it's one of those things that it's like a mom dish. It's a suburban mom dish. And so it reminds me a lot of, did you ever have goulash that's macaroni noodles?
Yeah.
It's kind of that same idea where it's just a lot of what you have in the fridge and some affordable ground meat and some noodles for bulk. And it's almost like hamburger helper in a way. Like it's just a soothing, really palatable, really easy dish, and kids love it. And it's one of those things that you can buy a packaged spice mix for your Dutch macaroni.
Yeah, it's a recipe that interested me because we're all so stressed for time.
Yes.
And this is something that you can make ahead of time and then put away and heat up when you're ready for it.
Yeah.
Or if you've got a few minutes at dinner and you know you can pull it off.
Yeah, exactly. And one of the things that I really appreciated reading about the Dutch and learning more about the culture was the value of leisure time. So you don't want to rush home after a busy day only to have to spend 2 hours cooking dinner. So I think that's important to be able to just, you know, pull a couple recipes out of your back pocket and have something you can make in half an hour.
The Dutch do leisure quite well, though, right?
In
terms of coffee, and it's a big part of the day.
Yeah, and sitting down. And actually, I laughed when we were there in January. All I wanted was a big cup of, you know, drip coffee,
yeah,
which is my staple, and I take it on the go everywhere I go. But you don't see people walking around with those big coffee cups. And I think that's nice because it's a real mental switch to have to sit down and actually think about what you're doing and have a little cookie and just talk to someone rather than, you know, always being on the go.
Yeah.
You know.
And speaking of cookies, they're marvelous recipes in here for not only desserts to have at mealtime, but snacks that you can put out for people and the sort.
Yeah. And one of the things I appreciate about a lot of Dutch baking is that it's sturdy, so it's meant to go with something like coffee or tea,
yeah,
and so it doesn't disintegrate when you dip it in a hot mug of,
yeah,
of liquid. So they're great cookies and treats for, you know, I bring them to work and serve them to the office ladies, and
yeah,
and we take a break every so often, and that's nice.
And so what's dessert, and what are sweets like at your house? Because I understand one of the fellows you live with is a diabetic.
Yes. So my husband has type 1 yeah, diabetes. He's on insulin, which actually is pretty helpful because you can moderate the dose.
I see.
But he doesn't have much of a sweet tooth anyway. My son, however, is a complete sugar monster. So a few of those recipes are specifically for him.
He has one in the book, doesn't he?
He has a couple, yes.
Yeah.
He has a pudding. So one of the things that was so great about the Netherlands is the dairy section is in the superstore, or supermarkets are huge.
Yeah.
So it's, you know, a wall and a half long and filled with all the most wonderful things. And one of the things is pitchers of pudding. So, you know, you just keep it in your fridge like milk and pour out the pudding when you want to have it. So that's a common dessert. And that was something that he just sort of took to immediately.
That sounds like the coolest thing to have in your fridge.
It is.
Yeah.
It's really neat. And so he, there's a recipe in there. It's adapted to his taste. I've added peanut butter.
But, yeah.
And a hot chocolate as well.
And then there was a moment in the book where you guys, the three of you, are in a place in the Netherlands.
Mm-hmm.
And you find out that you can have a sandwich that has chocolate in it.
Yes. So my husband's quite excited about beer. And the Netherlands is a great place if you're a beer enthusiast. And we went into this brewery in Harlem, and we didn't check if there was a kid's menu. He just really wanted to try the beer there. I'm not even sure if they had a kid's menu, because we opened up the menu, the English language one, and on the inner fold,
yeah,
there was a chocolate sandwich, just a regular, for grown-ups, chocolate sandwich, and he was in heaven.
You mentioned beer.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of places in the book where recipes call for beer.
Yeah.
And we live in such a beer-soaked city.
Yeah.
That it's easy. You can find what you like and what you can use, right?
Yeah, and I've tried to be helpful there. So I know that Vancouver is really big on hoppy beers.
Yeah.
Don't recommend cooking with those as much.
Uh-huh.
But I try to provide suggestions for where beer is called for, what a good beer would be. And, you know, you can find something like that locally that would speak to you maybe.
And we're in the time of year where soups are very useful and helpful and for all ailments and the sort. There's some great soups in the book. Sauto, is that how you pronounce it?
Sauto.
Sauto.
Yeah.
What is that? I was reading it and I thought, is it like pho?
Kind of.
Yeah.
It's the same idea of sort of a really nice clear broth with noodles.
Yeah.
So it's a chicken broth. It's got it's from Suriname, but it's got flavors of Indonesia as well.
And it seems easy to make. Like
yeah,
you would think that having to boil a chicken and the sort was time consuming. I mean, there is time involved, but it's you know, I could do it.
Yeah, and what's great is you can break the process up into. So if you want to make the broth the night before,
yeah,
and then just heat it up with some noodles and a boiled egg and some shredded chicken,
yeah,
that's perfectly fine. It'll all work, you know, to your schedule.
When you're making broth, stocks especially,
mm-hmm,
some people like to roast their bones, some people don't, whether it's beef or chicken.
Yeah.
Where are you on?
It kind of depends,
yeah,
what the recipe is and what my mood is. A lot of the time, if I'm making a chicken soup, I'll boil the whole chicken and do that. But I always save my carcasses.
From roasts?
Yeah. I just kind of, I have a big bag in the freezer that I shove them into, and when there's enough, I make a broth out of that.
Yeah.
Roasting off the bones works really well for beef.
Yeah.
Beef soups and pork soups. So.
Ribs, for example, do you save those bones?
If not if people have eaten,
eaten them with
their hands.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah.
But you could, I mean, if you were going to slice them off.
Yeah.
I bet it would be kind of a nice sort of sweet, smoky broth.
And a darker one, yeah.
Yeah.
Snert, that's uniquely Dutch.
Yes. I laughed really hard the first time I saw that name. It's a green soup. It's not the most appetizing name, but it's a really lovely soup. It's very hearty.
Is it pea-based?
Yeah. Green split peas.
Yeah.
And it commonly calls for a smoked pork hock or I use trotters sometimes, some sausage.
Yeah.
But just it's a really porky, hearty soup, and it's wonderful this time of year.
So because you have a kid at home, I'm assuming because he's been introduced to all these the different kinds of food, not only this book but the previous one, that his palate is quite expansive.
Well,
but I mean, kids can be picky too. So I'm wondering, does that factor in what you serve night in, night out?
Yeah, I mean, we try with him. He's allowed to have opinions, but he has to try everything.
Mm.
So over time, there's things he just doesn't like, and that's fine. He's never going to love mushrooms. So at this point, I don't force it anymore.
Yeah.
But we do really push him to taste things. A lot of stuff gets covered in ketchup, more than I really care to admit to.
Yeah.
But, yeah, kids are so funny because I think they have individual personalities and you can do everything right and you can expose them to flavors and they're gonna do what they're going to do.
Yeah.
So.
I eat, if I go out with people it annoys me a great deal, is when the minute that the food is plopped in front of them, they grab the salt, the pepper, or whatever sauce is on the table.
No.
You have a rule at your house about that.
You have to taste it first.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I don't want to spend, 20 minutes tinkering with the flavor of something for someone to just pour a bunch of hot sauce on it. So.
But do you keep a lot of sauces at home?
Yeah, I have a really... So I love condiments because one of the... I work full-time, and my husband does too, so a lot of evenings we're just pressed for time, and, some veggies and some condiments goes a long way to a quick meal, so mustards and hot sauces are our standbys. But
It's great to have. I mean, like, I was thinking the other night what to do with chicken, and so I just took some salad dressing.
Yep, you totally
can. And then just throw it in the bag and then let it sit there until I was ready to make it.
It's basically a marinade because you've got your mix of acids and oils in there. So.
Yeah. In your house, I mean, do you have a slow cooker? Do you use that regularly?
I do. Yeah, I'm actually I use it a fair bit during the wintertime especially because you want those homey flavors, but I'm at work a lot of the time. So we do use stuff like that. And a lot of the recipes in here will take to that.
Yeah.
You might just need to sort of take them out and give them a simmer to thicken them up.
Yeah, especially like a something that you want braised,
a
certain cut of meat, for example. You can't do that in half an hour to 45 minutes before dinner. So it's a good thing to do before you leave for work, right?
Yeah, you can do that way. Or else sometimes I just like the smell and the warmth. So I'll sometimes just make the next night's dinner while I'm making the other one. And it just can just sit while I watch some Netflix. And the next day it's perfectly good.
Instant Pot. I mean, everyone's talking about that recently.
Yeah, it's a great product. I've been borrowing my sister-in-law's because I've been waiting for the sale.
Yeah.
But they're great. Yeah. My friend just put out a book, How to Instant Pot, and it's some great recipes in there too. It's a really great way to. The thing I like about it is it's got the timer and you can pressure cook, so you can make things like your rich stocks and sauces. You can set it to just before you get home.
Yeah, I was talking a moment ago about some of the flavors that are familiar for me. Maggie, is that how you pronounce it?
Yeah, I pronounce it Maggie. My husband pronounced it Mahi, but I don't know that that's right.
Yeah, or Maggi, I guess, is another way that I've heard it growing up. But I mean, that was something that I always saw in our kitchen growing up.
It's such a weird thing because everybody kind of has it, and it's like the ultimate umami sauce.
So, what does it taste like? If people are asking you,
It's like a very sort of sweet soy sauce, but not in the style of something like a ketchup manis or something like that. So it's very strongly flavored. You only need a few drops. But what it does is it provides sort of a nice sort of background savoriness to dishes.
You mentioned ketchup manis. You can make that.
You can.
And there's a recipe in the book for how to do that, right?
There is. But there's a brand I really like that you can get in Vancouver, and it costs, $5 at most, which... For me, that's what I usually use, is ABC brand. It's an Indonesian brand.
We're coming up to Christmas.
Mm-hmm.
I'm assuming that when you're with your in-laws, will you be cooking stuff from the book?
I might be, yeah. I did, I cooked Christmas dinner last year, and we did a Reisstaffel, which is a mix of as many dishes as you can fit on a table, basically. And it was very popular with the kids, especially, because a lot of that is skewered chicken or meatballs and noodles and things like that. This year I'll probably do the pork roast. There's a rolled pork roast in there that's really nice for the holidays, with pears and currants and a little bit of rosemary.
Yeah. Again, you have the things that can go with that in the book, right? I mean, potatoes or braised vegetables of the sort, right?
Yeah, I don't want to leave you alone with one recipe. You should have enough to go on.
You tell us the story of Sinterklaas and Swarty Pete. Is that I remember seeing that in The Office. Dwight mentioned them one year.
And, forgotten about that.
Yeah, and so that's the story. That's Dutch Christmas, right?
Yeah, so so it's St. Nicholas arrives for Sinterklaas on, I think it's December 6th.
Uh-huh.
So it's before Christmas Day, which is a separate thing, though they're starting to sort of merge a little bit, especially as a lot of North Americans make their home in the Netherlands. But, so that is the first celebration, is early December. And
It's a different sort of Christmas story to tell kids.
Yes.
and people should really pick up the book, because you tell the story in here, the back of the book. I'll just get you to tell us just a little bit about, when you tell kids the story nowadays, what's the reaction usually?
Well, so, Black Pete, he's going through a bit of a rebrand right now, and I think that's a good thing. So Black Pete has historically been, St. Nicholas's helper.
Mm.
And, Black Pete is in the mythology and in the story that people commonly refer to, he is a chimney sweep. But his, when you go back and you look at the origin of Black Pete, that's not the case.
Mm.
So he is he's a character that was invented around the time that slavery was still going on, and he was meant to be sort of a sinister character. So if you were bad, Black Pete would take you away.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you're good, you get presents, but if you're bad, you get kidnapped. Which, I mean, a lot of cultures will have sort of a version of that.
Yeah.
But I think in this case, over time, the character's nature has changed, and now he's sort of a beloved character. But a lot of that original, the black skin paint.
The negative stereotypes. What I found interesting was that sometimes heightened over time.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think as an outsider, I think it's easy to see that maybe that's not ideal.
Yeah.
But when you're in it and that character has fond memories for you, a lot of people are having a really hard time letting go or thinking about that character maybe based on what he originally was intended to be.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's every year now there's protests and people are upset, and I think rightly so.
Mm-hmm.
They don't want to be caricatured.
Yeah.
And over time, he's come to be... people are starting to embrace the whole Chimney Pete idea.
Yeah.
So now it's not, you know, blackface.
Yeah,
it's
yeah.
just a little bit of soot on the cheeks. And I think that's, as we go forward, I think that's how it's going to be. I think that people are starting to see the negative connotations of that character and how he's represented.
And it's a part of heritage, and there are great lessons in all of this too, right?
Yeah, we don't have to keep the parts of our heritage that are bad or that are, you know, hurtful to other people.
I hate to ask this of authors every time I talk to them and they're promoting a new book, but I mean, are you working on the next thing? Is there something upcoming?
Well, I tend to have a really bad habit of overdoing things, and so I overwrote a lot for this book, and a certain amount of it was cut, and that's because we just, you know, we don't have, you know, 300 pages for me to expound on work-life balance and things like that, but so... As I'm moving forward, I'm starting to think of more the things that were interesting to me about women and working and balancing family and leisure and all of that were particularly interesting in the context of Dutch culture. And I think that I was sort of looking at it as an aspirational thing, this idea of not feeling defined by your career and valuing leisure time in a way that I don't think we do here.
Yeah.
And so as I go forward, I'm starting to think about writing about women and working and just how we balance it all, given the so many expectations.
In your travels to the Netherlands, how different is the lifestyle for, say, a working mom as opposed to here?
There is more support, for sure. So one of the things I struggled with here is care, for example. It's really hard and expensive to find care. Mm-hmm. And if you don't live near family, who will help you? Mm-hmm. And they're not expected to help you here the way it's, you know.
In other countries, right?
Yeah, exactly. So it has more of a family is very important there. It's a widely held value. Everybody, you know, agrees it's important. And people pitch in. So grandparents, you know, take a day a week of care. And care is affordable. And it's something that people don't struggle with the same way they do here.
Yeah.
And it's, I mean, most women work part-time. A lot of men work part-time as well. And they just sort of, I guess there's a better understanding of the role of family and the importance of nurturing the next generation of kids. And
I'm sure it's not as expensive as Vancouver.
Oh, I don't think so. No, but, and it's also more active, which is great. So you'd see moms with, you know, a few kids on the back of the bike just commuting, and just the whole lifestyle felt just less frazzled, I guess, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
So I find just it felt like you could breathe.
Yeah.
And if you go to the grocery store at the end of the day, say you're going to hop on the train to go home, there's little grocery stores that have meals sort of made that you don't have to stress over, and it's really nice.
Yeah, and I guess they don't do what we do in this part of the world where it's a big shop once a week or every few days.
Yeah, well, a lot of people live in cities and apartments. Hey,
that's a European way, I guess, is you pick up what you need that day, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And there's little markets around, so it's just, you know, you're not hoarding food that way. Yeah. You really think about what you want to serve.
Yeah.
And the packaging is great because you get smaller portions. So, you know, I can get a small amount of what I need for dinner, and the rest of it doesn't turn to liquid in the crisper.
Yeah. There's a lot we can learn from the Dutch, isn't there?
There is, I think. Just in terms of I guess we get so worked up about stuff here. Like, we overthink everything. And there, you know, exercise is just as simple as riding your bike or walking to the store. It's not, there's not this weird compulsion to, you know,
make appointments for things. And
exactly. You just sort of incorporate activity and leisure and moments of relaxation into your day. And that's something I think we could all benefit from more of.
Yeah. The one thing that I've admired about you, especially after reading this book and the previous one, and it's something that you say in Dutch Feast that I found particularly poignant. The way we eat can change how we see the world. And I think a lot of us, because we eat regularly, we eat every day, don't think about what we eat and what that means.
Well, yeah, I think we can be mindless about it, but once you start sort of paying attention to your food, you can see things like influences from elsewhere.
History, even.
Exactly. And, like, you have to think about, well, how did we get this? So, for example, how did we get, you know, curry or spices and things, and where did they come from? And once you start to look at the origin of what we're eating, it gives you sort of a bigger picture. You're not just, you know, throwing something together in Vancouver on a weeknight. You're part of something bigger, and you're drawing on a history that's quite vast and complicated.
Well, as I said, I've admired your work over the years.
Thank you.
And this book is just a fine achievement. Congratulations on it, and good luck with it. It's a pleasure to meet you.
Thank you so much for having me. It's always a pleasure.
Wellfedflatbroke.com is the website. Dutch Feast is the name of the book. Do get it. You'll want to get a copy for yourself because you want to make the stuff in it. And then you'll want to give a copy or two to other people, especially this time of year for Christmas. And it's available throughout Vancouver and elsewhere, wherever you're listening to this. Dutch Feast is the title. Arsenal Pulp Press is the publisher. It's author Emily White. Join me in person here in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Monta.